were talking about the convoys you were on, and you were on several convoys, which you don't remember individually, so...
Well, there were 21 I was on.
And one incident that I know we're interested in is when you were caught in the tail end of a hurricane. Can you set the scene for us? What convoy were you on then? It was towards...
I didn't realise at the time, but we were escorting landing craft, obviously, for D-Day. These were big landing craft. They were... bows opened sideways with the vent that came down, you know, great big things. We hit some bad weather, and it was bad. We were told it was the tail end of a hurricane. And it was so bad, in fact, that we had to turn the skipper, disband the convoy, and we had to turn into it. And unfortunately, I was on watch at the time, and no one was allowed on the upper deck, not even with this contraption I'd mentioned earlier. That you hang on to get from forward to aft, and vice versa. You just swing off the ship. I mean, it was hopeless. And unfortunately, as I said, I was on watch, on a 4-hour watch, and I couldn't get relieved. And we were there for 4 blinking days, the chief stoker, leading stoker and myself. And it was desperate. We had nothing to eat and nothing to drink. Well, we had water out of evaporation, so I could get hold of that. Because I haven't been making the water at the time, as the tanks have been getting low. It was our job in the engine to make the water, and the distilled water it was. In fact, we used to have to take special tablets so that because our nails used to crack up.
I'll come back to the evaporated water. So you had the water. What else did you have?
We had corned beef. Now it was, you know, I say corned beef, sounds an odd thing, but we found a crate, a whole crate of corned beef in the engine room. By pure chance, how he got there or who put it there, we never did find out. But thank God they did, because we opened this crate up, opened the tins, and we ate corned beef and water. No bread, no nothing really. And I got a bit fed up with it after 4 days, and never eaten it since. We called it corn dog in the Navy, incidentally. It's always known as corn dog. And we used to have it in those days frittered, in shepherd's pie, you name it. There was always a recipe which you could include called dog in. It's that Manchester tart I used to have. And anyway, I managed to get a bit of sleep, well, you both did, by hanging on to 2 valves that were on and 2 different pipes on the evaporator. But I could just get to just the right height, luckily, put my arm over each one, and I hung there. And managed to get a snatched bit of erratic sleep. Anyway, on the 4th day, and we were really fed up, the two of us. We'd had enough of this, being thrown about all the time. It was really dangerous. You had to hold on to and strap yourself on all the time to something. And on the 4th day, it had calmed down a lot. And the officer that watched on the bridge, he telephoned down and said, "I want someone up here straight away." So there's only one person who could go, because the leading stoker couldn't leave the engine room. And so I had to go, and I put my head out of the hatch, and the wind was still howling, and the ship was still rolling like hell, and it was raining, and it was just getting light, just light, but it was a lot better than it had been. I mean, I thought we were going to go over, quite frankly, one time, and it took me a long time to, oh, he said, by the way, come along the port side, because that's the leeward side, and don't come on, and, you know, get onto the bridge that way. It was still very dangerous, and it took me some time to get there. When I got up there, I couldn't make out what he wanted a stoker for on the bridge. And then he pointed to the mast. Well, as you know, on a ship, the mast, the top of the mast is the bit that moves the farthest. So the deeper you are in the ship, the less it moves. You sit there, like that. This is going right over there, but this is only moving a little bit. That's why we're always better off in the engine room. And he pointed up there, and he said, "The siren up there is jammed. It's not working. We need it for landing up the convoy. This really great stuff." And why it came on the engine room branch? Because it was not worked by steam. Anything that worked by steam was down to the engine room, because we had to make the steam. And I looked up there, and I saw this mast going from left to right, and I thought, "There's no way Ralphie's going up there. There's no way I'm going up there." So I realised the time was about 10 or 5 to 8. I was due to be relieved at 8 o'clock. So I said to the officer of the watch, I said, "I need some tools for that, sir. have to go and get them. He said, well, okay, but hurry along. We need to get it cleared pretty quickly. It's full up with salt water, I think. And so I went to get down to the engine room, and it took just enough time so that I was relieved by another poor sod who had to go up the mast and do that job. So I never did have to do it. I skived out of it. I'm not ashamed of it either. He hadn't been 4 days on watch like I had. It's been a bit fresher. So that was that story. And oh, when we started to round up the convoy, well, I think there were 50 of these landing craft. There were 10 short. Now, we never did find them. And we hunted and hunted and hunted for them. And I don't know how many crew they had. They must have had at least 10 on each one, scheduling crews. And that was 100 men just disappeared. And that was that convoy. Very sad.
So, any other duties you remember?
Duties?
Any or particular incidents on these convoys?
One I'm ashamed of, which I suppose you'd better go down for the record. We were halfway across the Atlantic. Now, as you know, the one thing you must not do, and that's the ship must not stop under any conditions during wartime because you're sitting duck. And one day I was down in the engine room on watch, which was the leading hand, and I'd taken my course, by the way, from second class stoker to first class stoker on board, and doing an exam and so on, and a few simple tests, and I got my bit of promotion. But it was still the leading hand, that was the next set up, who was in full charge. Well, as I mentioned earlier, you cannot speak down there, the noise is so horrendous. And he was pointing like this down, down the bilge, looking at me, attracting my attention, and he was pointing like this. So I thought, oh, he wants that valve turned off. He was pointing at this valve, and it was a red one. I didn't know that you never shut off red valves. So he carried on doing whatever he was doing, and I started to turn this valve. As I turned it, the light started to get lower and dimmer. And then the hooter went off, then a siren went off, then a whistle blowed. The lights got dimmer. Signal from the bridge was ringing, and flashing, and everyone was going bananas. I thought, whatever's happened? And the leading hand said, what have you done? What have you done? I said, well, he told me to turn off that valve. It was a master fuel valve from the main tanks. The whole ship was coming to a halt. And what he'd done, he'd pointed some oil on the plates, and he'd gone like that. In other words, mop up the oil. And it was right next to this bloody valve. I didn't know, I just turned the valve on. So he quickly turned it on, and we just caught it in time before the engine stopped. And off we went again. Well, of course, there was all hell to play. And I didn't go in front of the skipper, but the leading hand did. Because I hadn't taken my exam by then, I was still a second class stoker. A second class stoker cannot take the beginning of the battle, as we call it, get into trouble. It's down to the leading hand, and he got a rollicking, a serious one too, and because he hadn't made it clear what it meant, because it's highly dangerous to have oil on the plates when you're rolling about. I mean, you can kill yourself, literally.
But tell me about some of these duties. I mean, you mentioned two forms of duty now down there, other than what you mentioned earlier. One was the evaporation. Tell me about the evaporation
diesel electrics, they could do 23,000 miles without, I think it was 23,000 miles, without refuelling. We never did, of course, we always fuelled up when we were back. Either at Agencia, in a place called Agencia, around the corner, around the other side of the Newfoundland, the big oiling station, or at Scapa Flow.
Well, tell me, how did you refuel? That's one thing people don't know.
Nor do I, really. Just plugged it in and poured it in. I don't know how it worked. How does it work? I haven't any idea. From the tank, because I'd both gravity fed. I would have thought so.
So, the evaporation.
You'd have to ask a seaman there. And, yes, well, we also carried big tanks of fresh water, of course, but they ran out because we could do so many miles without refueling that the water was never enough, especially when we wanted to have a shower and one thing or another. And so we had these things called evaporators, which turned the salt water into fresh water. But it was distilled water, and distilled water is about as much good to you as I don't know what, because it's got nothing in it.
How did they work?
And when you boil up the water, if you boil up water, the salt is the not steam. Steam is, you can't see steam. It's water vapor you see coming out of a kettle. And what do? You condense it in the condensers, so that you leave the salt behind, and the condensed water is the pure water. And you have a hydrometer, which is a brass tube with a handle on the side, and you get a, and it's got a what do you call it? A float, with a needle through the middle of it, a round float, a needle through it, and you put it in this tube, and you see just how much, you can tell how much salt, and it should be on the naught all the time. If it isn't, you're doing something wrong, you could adjust. I just forget how you adjusted it now.
So that's evaporating. Now, the other thing you mentioned, we were on the light and power supply side of things.
Yes.
Tell me about that. What did that job entail?
Well, there's a 12 cylinder engine, which is an auxiliary engine. It was used for auxiliary lighting, and when you're in harbour, for instance, all the big engines shut down, and you need lighting on the board, and you need cooking facilities and so on, and you need a lot of power. And that's what a 12 cylinder was for. And also, it automatically, I think, came in when your main supply packed up. But for instance, we once dropped a depth, and we thought we were over chasing a sudden U-boat, and we dropped a pattern of depth charges. That's a diamond, we call them. Shape of a diamond, two over the end, and then four a little bit, and two over each side, and then two over the arm, and then the U-boat should be in the middle. Do you know how depth charge works? Do you want me to tell you?
Yes, but keep to the story first.
They dropped this pattern, this diamond, and it was a bit too close. We weren't going fast enough, and the whole ship rattled and banged and crashed, and all the lights went out. The bulbs broke. The vibration was so great. It set the cellular lighting. And immediately, the 12-foot cylinder engine came in automatically, and all the lights came on again. But I say immediately, it must have been half a minute or so. And when you're in the pitch dark, absolutely black as the hand, you know, you just can't see a hand in front of you, you shit yourself. And isn't very clever. Anyway, the auxiliary lighting came on, and that was that. That's all there is to it.
Now, tell me more about the depth charges then. That wasn't your pigeon, was it?
No, but I knew how they worked, which was quite interesting, really, because you see, when you've got a U boat below, it could be anywhere 10 feet under the surface, 20 feet, 40 feet, right on the bottom. Anywhere. How do you know when the depth charge is going to be level with the U boat to blow it up? And what they do, they have to somehow, some apparatus, not on the depth charge itself, but which, from the, I think it's from the seaman will tell you a bit better than I can, the ping you get from Aztecs, who tell you the depth of the submarine. Then what you do, on the side of the depth charge, there's a gauge which with holes, and as you turn it, you make these holes smaller or bigger. And so when it's fired into the water, into the sea, the water goes through these holes, and the faster the water goes in, the faster it will drop. And also, it will stop when it's filled up at a certain distance. And it has been calculated, the distances, that's where the U-boat is. It sounds a bit Heath Robinson, but it seemed to work pretty well. Do you follow what I say? Good. And that was that, really. Oh, we did drop, when we went off the Labrador Banks once and St. John's, we fired the depth charge in practice run. We dropped one depth charge, and you should have seen the cod that came up. Fish everywhere. Great big things, enormous. And so we immediately got buckets and tying rope on them and slinging his buckets over the side, trying to catch these fish. You've got a much chance of catching even a dead fish in a bucket, because it floats on the surface of the bucket. You can't scoop it along. So in desperation, because the fish was only stunned, they started to suddenly flip and go under again. So they quickly lowered the whaler, and they went went out to these fish and brought in as many as they could, and we had fish, cod for a fortnight after that. Beautiful cod. So that was the result of dropping one depth charge. I think the skipper must have done it on purpose to give us some fish. Yeah.
Now, one story is that when you actually went to jail, this business about your daughter was born on 14th of March 1944.
Oh, yes.
That's quite early in your time on the ship, really.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that story?
Well, we got into St John's in March, about March the 20th, something like that. And there was a cable waiting for me. And it said that I was the father of a baby daughter. And I remember jumping up on the mess table and saying, oh boy, it's a girl. And I was rather pleased about that. So when we got back to England after that trip, I wanted to see my daughter. Well, unfortunately, that was not to. I thought that was not to be, because every time we got into Liverpool, half a ship's company got leave. We called it boiler cleaning leave in those days. Half a ship's company got leave, and the other half had to stay on board for the running of the ship and make care and maintenance. And unfortunately, it was not my turn to go on leave. I didn't care about this so much. I wanted to see this daughter. I might not come back the next time.
This is your first child.
First child, yeah. I only made one mistake in a lifetime. And but I wasn't due to go on leave. I had to stay on board a ship. Well, being in Liverpool, and my wife just being down in Shelford and St. Peter in Buckinghamshire, didn't seem so very far away. And I was on auxiliary watch keeping with this 12-cylinder diesel engine. And I had to do 12 hours on and 12 hours off, because you can sleep a lot of the time, and you get called by the duty watchman or something if you hear something go wrong. So I said to the chap I was doing it with, he was doing 12 and 12 as well, will you do 24 for me, and I'll do 24 for you when I get back. I want to see my daughter, and I won't be missed that way. I thought that'd be all right. The job's been covered. What the hell? So I skipped ship, and I hitchhiked all the way from Liverpool to Cheltenham Peter in Buckinghamshire. Arriving there about tea time, as I got there, there was a telegram for me, which saying return to ship immediately. So I had a cup of tea and hitchhiked all the way back to Liverpool, and got on board about midnight. And as I went on board the Kenway actually said, you're in for it, mate. And I was taken in front of the duty officer, and he said, where the hell have you been? And I apparently someone had asked for me, which was very rare, it was just unfortunate. And I got caught. Well, that I thought, well, I'd only be number 11, like I've had in barracks, chasing up and down with a rifle or something. But it was far more than that. They issued me with a warrant for my arrest. The skipper issued me with a warrant for my arrest while I was on board ship. And to issue a warrant, they have to read the charges out in front of you, in front of the whole ship's company. We only had half a ship's company. It was still quite a lot of men, about 40, 50 men. And I had to go in front of the skipper on the quarterdeck, in front of the whole crew, to have this warrant read out. So everyone, this was at 12 o'clock I was due, and the man was guarding me down in the mess day. It was all ridiculous, really. And everyone's giving me, the rum came up at 11:30, and everyone's giving me slippers. And what happened, of course, I was blind to drunk. So they carried me upstairs, up the companionway, and I vaguely knew what was going on. I stood in front of the skipper and another couple of officers. All the crew were lined up, half the crew rather, lined on both sides of the deck. And he started to read out the charge. I had a man out of side of me holding me up. When you're on defaulters, that's called defaulters, you have to take your cap off in the Navy. So off cap, so I was struggling to find the edge of my cap, take it down. And then he started reading out the charge, and he went on and on and on. And then the very last one was absence from place of duty by enjoying war, maximum penalty, death. That sobered me up. Pretty damn quick. And and that was it. The skipper went off. And I was taken back down to the mess deck with two chaps guarding me. It was all ridiculous for each of our mates guarding me. And then they came from an LDD, that's Liverpool Destroyer Depot, in a jeep with two jaunties, as we call them, Navy police, cases and things, and carted me off to the LDD. Well, I
LDD,
had Liverpool Destroyer Depot. I never heard of it until then, and it was a barracks in Liverpool. And I was handcuffed, and they took me in. And this is all because I wanted to see my daughter for a few hours. And they took me into the regulation office there, and the chief petty officer said, right, strip down to your vest and pants, take your thumb ring off your finger, take your shoelaces out of your shoes, and no belt. And they gave me a pair of trousers that came out here.
Too big.
Far too big. I had to wrap them around me. And believe it or not, it had arrows all over it. And I had a jacket as well, which was far too big, with no buttons on. And I was marched down to, there was a row of cells. I was put in a cell which was about 4 feet wide and about 12 feet long, with a board, can I describe it as a board, that was chained up to the wall on either end and you let down to sleep on. And I was put in there, holding up my trousers, of course, and I was told I was on 24 hours hard layers. And that 24 hours consisted of water and hardtack biscuits and picking 14 pounds of oakum that I mentioned earlier for caulking. Now, the oakum was cut up into, so I couldn't hang myself, I suppose, into 1-inch pieces. And I had to pick it and fluff it all up, and it's hard.
Can you explain what it is? People don't know now.
Well, it's, yeah, I mentioned earlier, didn't I, it's for caulking on ships between the planks. And it's called oakum, and it's like jute, made of jute string. Only instead of having the long line, a roll of it, to tap it in between, it was all cut into inch pieces so that I can hang myself, I suppose.
What was picking it?
But I had to get hold of each little piece and pull it apart and fluff it all up so it's fluffy. And I had to do 14 pounds of this in 24 hours. Well, I did about 7 or 8 pounds of it by the time 24 hours was up. I just couldn't do any more. My fingers were bleeding, and the chap was in charge of it said, "Oh, that's all right. Don't worry about it. You've not done too badly." So I got off the rest of that. Now, this was interesting. After I finished my 24 hours hard layers. Oh, there was a jerry in the cell, by the way, but you couldn't sit on it. It had a lid on it, but you couldn't sit on it because it was a sharp edge. It was only meant for peeing in. And
so this was your punishment, was it?
This was my punishment. I got 14 days of this, and what was I going to say? Oh, yes. After the 24 hours, you were then given 6 inches of chain. Each door had a chain on it, and you could open the door 6 inches. And you could talk to the chap in the next cell, so you wouldn't go into that. So you weren't in solitary confinement. I think it's specially allowed because they didn't want to say anyone being in solitary confinement. And you could chat to the bloke next to you. Anyway, when it came to slopping out, we had this bloody tin with a lid on it, holding your trousers up with your elbows, and everything's done at a double. You can imagine me just slopping it. Down to the ablutions and cleaning it out, washing yourself and so on, and then double back to your cell again. After the first 24 hours, I was still getting another job of picking mattresses. The mattresses that came out of barracks and had been peed on, quite frankly, by young kids. And they'd been sterilised, but they're all stained and one thing. And we had the horsehair. We used to have to pick those and fluff them up. Make new mattresses out of them. Ah, now then, every afternoon we had to go exercising in the yard, and it was summertime, I think, it was a very nice day. And in those days, I used to be the tallest. I'm not now, because all the cotton little boys since the war and the orange juice, the lads are a lot taller than me. But it was always shortest to the left and tallest to the right, or the other way round. And I was the tallest, I was at the head of the queue. There were 14 cells, 16 cells, so 16 men. And it was double march. So we had a double round this yard, back down the other side for an hour, with a 5 and 10 minute break at a half hour. Well, at one end there was a high tenement building, and there must have been an office in one of the sections, one of the departments, and because there were girls sitting up there in the window, about four or five girls, having tea. It was obviously their tea break, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And as we came, don't forget, I was leading the party, as we came trotting around, they all started laughing and giggling. And I looked down, and I discovered that these trousers I was holding up had fallen open. And if a gander opened up and swallowed me, I'd been delighted. The next time I came round, I made sure my trousers were well covering me. And when the girl shouted, "It's all right, Jack, it's nothing we haven't seen before." Anyway, after the exercise, went back to the cell, and it was ridiculous. The lights went out at 9 o'clock. She said they had 9 o'clock till 6 or 8 in the morning in darkness, and there was no way to sling it. You had your hammock with you, but you couldn't sling it anywhere. You had to put it on top of these boards that came down on two chains. Incidentally, during the 24 hours hard layers I mentioned earlier, you weren't allowed to have your hammock. You had to lie on the hard board. And the officer came round at 9 o'clock and opened the little taps, and you had to. The call was light to attention. You had to light to attention. This officer said, "Everything all right?" And you said, "Yes, sir." You know, and then the lights went out. Anyway, I discovered to my I worked it out. I got 14 days of this, but the ship leaves in 5 days' time. Now, if that's the case, I shall miss that trip. I'll be put into barracks after 14 days, awaiting arrival of the ship. And while I've been put into barracks, I'll put in for leave, awaiting arrival of the ship, and hope to get it. I thought this is going to be a bit of all that's going to work out all right. On the fifth night, at about midnight, there's a crashing and a banging, and you know, they don't care about whether anyone's awake or asleep. They came to my cell and said, "Out, out there." And I said, "What's going on?" They said, "You'll find out, you'll find out." And so they hooked me out of the cell, took me to the regulation office, put on your uniform, put on my uniform, sir, took me back to the ship. They weren't going to sail without me. And I was told to continue my punishment on board ship. Well, they can't lock you up. They need me down in the engine room. Everyone has a job to do. So they said that the officer of the watch, Jimmy rather, said, "When we get to Gibraltar," we're going to Gibraltar at that time, "when you get to Gibraltar, you're to double up and down for half an hour on the jetty by the side of the ship, with holding an old rifle above your head, the old number 11s again." And I said, "Oh, that's fair enough." So when we got down to Gibraltar, sure enough, I was given the rifle, and I had to double up again. It just so happened, the skipper looked over at the side, looked from up above on the bridge, and saw me there, and he said to the Jimmy, the first lieutenant, "What the hell is that man doing, doubling up and down with a rifle over his head?" He said, he's finishing off his punishment, sir. This is as sore as I assume it. And he said, "Well, tell him, silly bugger, to come back in board again and stop this nonsense." So I got off that as well. I never did do my complete punishment, but I got a black mark on my record.